Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We all worry about future energy supplies and the climate cost of what we've got right now. We have to choose between big utility mega projects or toss some solar panels on the roof, right? Wrong, according to Greg Paul, the author of a new book, Power from the People: How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. It's part of the Post-Carbon Institute's Community Resilience series with a foreword by Van Jones. Greg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
What is a local energy project? Can you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. One that immediately comes to mind is the Ellensburg Community Solar Project in Ellensburg, Washington, which was one of the first of its kind in the nation. It came online in 2006 after about 3 years of collaborative effort on the part of the municipal utility, the Washington University Extension Service, and also local citizens who all participated to make this 150-kilowatt solar electric project a reality. Another example would be the Fox Islands Wind Project in Vinyl Haven, Maine. This project was first conceived in 2001, and after a lot of hard work by the Fox Islands Electric Cooperative, a number of other area organizations, and the island residents as well, the $14 million three-turbine 4.5-megawatt project was completed in 2009. There's another very different example, which is the Harney District Hospital Pellet Heating Plant in Burns, Oregon, where the hospital was planning a new building back in 2005. They decided to include a new 500,000 BTU pellet-fired boiler to replace a previous system that relied on propane for fuel, and it was the first of its kind in the state, and has not only worked better than expected, but has also reduced the hospital's heating costs substantially.
Well, those sound pretty exciting for me. We don't tend to think about energy in political terms, but you do encourage us to include politics. In your mind, what is the difference between a democratic energy system from one that is undemocratic?
Well, a democratic energy system is one that is owned by the people whom it serves, not by some distant corporation. This could be a small local energy project, like a community solar project that I mentioned just now, or perhaps a much larger organization, like a public utility district, which is very popular on the west coast of the United States.
And you focus on these local projects over large centralized energy. Why do you feel the local angle is so important?
It's about the local economy, basically. Local energy projects keep your energy dollars circulating in the local economy rather than exporting it out of state or even out of country in some cases. And that local money circulating in your local economy creates what's known as the multiplier effect. And so that money gets re-spent over and over again in the local economy. It's all about strengthening the local economy.
On the other side, big government seems stalled or even hostile to local power. Do we need them at all?
Well, yes, ideally. But some progress is better than no progress at all. And I'm afraid that if we wait around for the federal government, especially Congress, to lead on these issues, not much is going to happen. So, sure, if the federal government would play a cooperative role in all of this, it certainly would make things easier and we would get there faster. But, again, you don't have to wait around for Congress for your local community to get involved in a project of its own.
Greg Paul, 6 years ago you wrote the Citizen-Powered Energy Handbook. What has changed since then?
That's a good question. I think probably local attitudes have certainly changed about that, and a lot of rules and regulations that used to be barriers are beginning to change as well. In addition, more communities and local groups are frustrated by the lack of progress at the national level and have decided to take matters into their own hands. They're also seeing the progress made in other communities and want to follow these early examples with projects of their own. So I think those are the major differences.
Well, and I guess, too, some of the sources of alternative energy have become cheaper, like solar panels, for example.
Yes, dramatically.
Well, let's say I'm living in a condo or I'm renting. I've got no way to add renewable energy personally. How can I still participate in providing local energy?
Well, actually, I do mention one example of a family who managed to convince their condo association in Chicago to let them install a solar array on the roof of the condo. But admittedly, that's generally not an easy thing to do because of the complexity of condo association rules and regulations. So for most people, the best way for condo or apartment dwellers to participate is to try to locate a community solar or other group renewable project in their area that they can perhaps either invest in or perhaps participate in as subscribers. There are a number of different models that I describe in the book that would work in that kind of a situation.
And when we're thinking about our personal energy use, you suggested sometimes the best move can actually be to move. When does buying a new home make the greatest energy sense?
Another good question. I guess it depends on a number of different situations. If a move meets a number of needs at the same time, but especially if it avoids a long commute from a distant suburb, it can make a lot of sense. Also, if you are perhaps a family with an empty nest, so to speak, your kids are gone, you're looking to perhaps downsize to a smaller home, that might be an obvious time to consider relocating. But when you make that decision to relocate, you need to keep in mind the idea of reducing commuting as much as possible. That's really the main thing.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with local energy expert Greg Paul. Greg, a growing number of community wind projects around the United States are community in name only. They bring little benefit to the localities in which they're sited. How could such projects be truly community-based, and would that make them more popular?
Yes, it's mostly a matter of ownership. If the community is proposing its own project that will directly benefit the local residents, most people will support it over another project that's owned by some out-of-state corporation that will siphon off most of the energy and probably most of the project benefits as well. The big commercial wind farms tend to be enormous in size and scale, which certainly raises a lot of legitimate issues for many local people. And most community wind projects tend to be much smaller in size and scale. Instead of involving perhaps hundreds of turbines, it might just involve two or three. The Fox Island wind farm I mentioned earlier is a good example of just three commercial scale turbines instead of, 30 or perhaps 100. So even though the community projects are smaller, because the ownership stays local, virtually all of the benefits go to the local community, and that makes a huge difference. And the other thing is that if you get the community involved in their own project, out of necessity, you involve the local community in all of the early planning and all the discussions, and the problems that do come up are normally solved at the local level. And people are generally the best judges of what's right for their own communities.
Are those community-based projects, like those three wind turbines, are they still tied into the grid in such a way that if you have a big blackout throughout the whole grid, do you lose community power then too?
In general, most of these community projects are tied into the grid. And in general, if the entire grid goes down, you would have to isolate that power from that project until the grid was brought back up. But these systems can be set up so that the community could benefit immediately in that kind of a situation.
Moving to hydroelectricity, most people picture rivers and big dams, but not all projects need those dams. How could cities near rivers generate hydroelectricity without a dam?
Yes, it is possible. It depends a little bit on the particular situation, but in some locations, it's certainly possible to generate electricity with a so-called run-of-river strategy that does not involve a dam. In this case, there is an inlet upstream for the water to be temporarily borrowed for the hydro project, runs through a pipe, goes into the generator, the turbine generator, and exits at the other end out what's called a tail race. This really doesn't really back up the river. It doesn't really affect river flow substantially. It doesn't involve any silting, which is a big problem with large dams. And so there's a very, very low impact of that type of project. And there are quite a few of those that are either in existence already in many locations or are being planned. It's a real low-impact way of generating hydroelectricity, and it's definitely a very renewable strategy.
You're not a fan of hydrogen in the alternative energy mix. Why is that?
I guess the simplest answer is that hydrogen is basically a net energy loser. Supplies of pure hydrogen don't really exist, so it has to be extracted from other sources, such as water. And in that process, you use a lot of electricity, and the conversion process always involves energy loss. The lack of any meaningful national hydrogen infrastructure is another major problem. It would take many, many years and billions of dollars to create that infrastructure, and that money could be better spent on other local energy projects that have a proven track record. I'm not saying that hydrogen has no future at all, but I think it's generally limited, and there are a lot of people who I think have unrealistic expectations about it.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with Greg Paul, author of the new handbook, Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. You warn the replacement of fossil fuel-based energy sources with renewables cannot meet our current energy use, especially with transportation. What is a realistic picture of our lifestyles 2 decades in the future? How will we get around? How will we heat our homes? And what would we have to perhaps live without?
Excellent question. And the transportation sector is the big one. We are just so totally dependent on fossil fuels for transportation. I guess the most realistic answer is that we will probably be traveling a lot less. People will tend to live closer to their work, which certainly is in line with my suggestion earlier about actually moving as a strategy to reduce your energy use. We will probably be using a lot more biomass and solar heating for heating our homes. Our homes are very vulnerable in terms of heating to fossil fuels, because we tend to rely on fossil fuels or electricity for home heating. And there aren't a lot of real easy substitutes for that. We'll probably be living with a lot less unnecessary stuff and focusing more on essentials.
Since the 2008 recession, finding financing for projects has been pretty challenging. How are communities interested in energy projects faring? What are some of the options beyond banks?
Well, actually, local banks are a good place to start looking. Local banks certainly have the best interests of their own communities in mind, and they tend to loan most of their money out for local projects. So even though it might not be the first place that you would think to look, it probably is one of the best for a local project. I was involved in a local solar energy project here in Vermont, and we got part of our financing from a local bank that was just quite happy to make that loan. There are a large number of alternative sources for project financing, but they tend to vary from state to state. So you have to check to see what's available in your particular state. But in general, if the project is well conceived and properly financed, financing is available for most of these projects. Some projects are self-financed by the participants, and new crowdfunding should be available next year once the Securities and Exchange Commission implements new rules governing this type of funding that was included in the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, the Jobs Act, signed by President Obama back in April. So there's a number of alternative sources of funding.
In Europe, feed-in tariffs, called FITs, have been an important part of funding renewable energy initiatives. What are FITs, and how could their wider use in North America encourage sustainable energy development?
A feed-in tariff is a policy mechanism designed to encourage investment in renewable energy technologies that generate electricity. FITs provide a guaranteed price and access to the grid that gives renewable energy projects the solid foundation that they need to attract investors and also to be able to make long-range plans. A feed-in tariff offers the promise of a model in which almost anyone can become a renewable energy investor and owner, and they're becoming increasingly used in different states around the country and even in municipalities, and they definitely have provided a real boost to renewable energy projects where they've been implemented.
Greg Paul, suppose our community wants to organize a local energy project. Do we still have to go through all the hoops, the expensive review processes and permits that the big coal, oil, and gas plants do?
Well, although there are some differences, the general regulatory and approval process is similar. A lot of federal, state, and local rules and regulations need to be changed or simplified to make it easier for small community projects that have strong local support. Now, in some cases, exemptions might make sense. And in other cases, a simplified process specifically designed for small local projects would be extremely helpful. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has oversight of hydro projects across the nation. And they've recently made some changes that have definitely sped up the process for approval, and I've cited one good example in the book. The regulatory and approval process at all levels has evolved over many years to reflect the large, centralized, corporate-dominated energy infrastructure of the 20th century. And it's going to take time to change that emphasis to reflect the new, more local realities of the 21st century.
Do you see local energy fitting in with the transition town movement?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Transition towns movement emphasizes relying on local resources for food, energy, money, and most of the other necessities of life. So, yes, it's an ideal fit.
Greg, I'm worried we may not have enough time to get local energy going, especially with the rules we just talked about, before the financial system dries up or crashes or before the weather disruption gets really bad. What has been the time lag between visioning a local project and getting that power or heat online in the community?
Well, it varies from community to community and from project to project, but I would say that it normally takes a few years to get a project organized and the legal, technical, and financial details worked out. In a local community solar project that I mentioned previously that I participated in here in Vermont, it took us 18 months to get it all lined up and only 39 days to build the thing.
Wow. Do you have a website for this new book or a place where we can find out more?
Yes, www.gregpahl.com, GREGPAHL.com.
Thank you. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've been listening to Greg Paul, author of a new book that helps individuals and communities develop their own local sources of energy. And that's what the world needs, in my opinion. The title is Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. It's from Chelsea Green Publishing and part of the Post Carbon Institute's Community Resilience series. Look for it in your local bookstore or order it online from all the usual sources. Greg, thank you for writing this useful book.
Well, thank you so much for letting me tell you about it today.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We started out this program with information on how to turn your community into a transition town, with examples from New England. Next week, we'll find out how this transition movement transcends many different political views. The famous alternative thinker Albert Bates joins us from the farm in Tennessee. Albert tells me transition can succeed in a red state, thick with Republican voters, even in a very rural community. We'll find out how. As you know, the transition movement started out in the UK with Rob Hopkins and his community. If you have local experiences you would like to share, be sure and send me an email with a short description of what is going on around you. We can pass that on to listeners, or perhaps you can be a guest on Radio EcoShock, sharing what works. Maybe you would like to suggest someone I should call as a guest. There are two ways to get in touch. Email me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org, radio@ecoshock.org, or go to our website at ecoshock.org and click on the contact button to send me your message. When it comes to transition, we all have a role to play and a voice to speak with. I appreciate hearing from you. We have a little time left to pass on this gem from another in my list of must-listen radio. This is from The Truth About Markets radio program broadcast from Resonance FM in London. Co-hosts Max Kaiser and Tracy Herbert have been warning for years the banking and corporate system are corrupt. They pretty well coined the term banksters back in the day when people still trusted banks and the markets. In this five-minute clip, Max, who worked for years in the markets and designed sophisticated trading software, and Tracy talk about new studies on one law for the rich and another for you and I.
Study shows, this is actually the first time this has been studied and with actual real numbers and looking at the cost-benefit analysis. Studies show CEOs are not subject to same rule of law as you. Recent academic papers begin the formal work of proving that CEOs and giant corporations face a completely different legal system than the rest of us, one in which their vast resources are used to ensure that they can safely ignore laws and rules applicable to small fry. One study looked at the influence of corporate lobbying on fraud detection, and it's called Corporate Lobbying and Fraud Detection, issue 46 of the Journal of Financial and Quantitative Analysis by Frank Yu of Barclays Global Investors and Zhuyan Yu of Indiana University. What they found was that firms' lobbying activities make a significant difference in fraud detection. Compared to non-lobbying firms, firms that lobby, on average, have a significantly lower hazard rate of being detected for fraud, evade fraud detection 117 days longer, and are 38% less likely to be detected by regulators. In addition, fraudulent firms, on average, spend 77% more on lobbying than non-fraudulent firms and spend 29% more on lobbying during their fraudulent periods than during their non-fraudulent periods. The delay in detection leads to a greater distortion in resource allocation during fraudulent periods. It also allows managers to sell more of their shares. So there's actually a direct statistical analysis you can do of how much less likely they are to be prosecuted by just bribing regulators and bribing politicians.
Sure. And they'll take that statistic and they'll turn it into a collateralized futures contract, trade it on the exchange, and make more money. So it's fraud within fraud within fraud. You know, the average, you know, like the trend of the global economy for individual wealth is down because the population is rising. You know, 7 billion people on planet Earth are sharing roughly the same amount of resources that we had 50 years ago. And those resources are shrinking because of all the stresses and strain of having 7 billion people on planet Earth. So the average, you know, wealth is for the 7 billion people on Earth is shrinking. Their wealth in terms of access to clean water, clean air, arable land, and a kind of a mental space that comes with having some open space is shrinking. It's shrinking rapidly. So the average person's wealth is shrinking. The only way to overcome this shrinkage is by committing fraud. You have to commit fraud, and this is what's being done. There's the only way to do it. Now, anyone who doesn't commit fraud is being foolish because there's no legitimate way that you can economically flourish in this global economy anymore. There's simply no more resources. So there's only fraud. There's only fraud that's left.
So they point to, for example, the Keating Five, the five senators who intervened in a criminal investigation and stopped it. They demanded an investigation into Lincoln Savings and Loans stop. And of course, if they found out that they were lobbied. But this study shows that this hideous perversion never stopped and not only includes direct campaign contributions, but also lobbying. They show that firms increase their lobbying expenses after they commit fraud. So remember the increase in lobbying by all the banks since 2008. These are their kickbacks they're giving directly and openly to avoid these prosecutions. So no wonder Goldman Sachs, look at their lobbying contributions, see how much they paid to avoid this prosecution. During the time that they are committing fraud, executives of lobbying firms sell their stock about four times more than firms that aren't lobbying. Then there's another study by Florida State University, and they find that accused executives whose firms have contributed to political campaigns via a PAC are banned as an officer for three fewer years than those at non-bribe-paying firms, serve probation for five fewer years on average than a non-bribe-paying firm, and prison for six fewer years, and are 75% less likely to be given both prison time and an officer ban, which is the most severe form of criminal and civil penalties. So huge drop in not only punishment and but in fines for those who have paid bribes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so it's all quantifiable. It's all broken down. It's all charting out. And you would think that that would be the basis for some criminal prosecutions, but instead it's being used by the other side, the bankers, to make markets in fraud. That will just make it easier for them to make markets, make money trading in fraud, and that's what they use all the data for.
That was Max Kaiser and Tracy Herbert from the August 11th Truth About Markets show on Resonance FM in London. Their website is maxkaiser.com. Use the search box on the homepage to search for Truth About Markets and listen to their programs or download them. By the way, Max Kaiser and Tracy are one of the few finance experts who also warn us about climate change rather than trying to deny it. It's refreshing. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The website is ecoshock.org, or look for each week's show blog with all of the links at ecoshock.info. We'll go out with this classic by Peter Gabriel. Something in the words and melody struck a chord in my heart this week. Look after one another, won't you? And thanks for caring about your world.
Resolution of all the fruitless soldiers.